Welcome. Today is the 4th of September, 2014. It's a Thursday. And we're joined here today live by Chris Jasper. And Chris has a lot of experience with Gregorian chant, and we'll be talking about that today. So Chris, if you could tell us how you got started with chant.
Sure. I grew up in Sacramento, California, originally born and raised in the Society of St. Pius X, because there were no other traditional masses around. Fraternity St. Peter hadn't come to Sacramento yet. And I grew up from birth surrounded by Gregorian chant and polyphony, both at church and at home, with many books, chant books, and recordings. And then when I was 11 or 12, I joined the church choir and schola. But then in 2001, we moved to the Fraternity St. Peter Parish in Sacramento, which had by that time been established. And I joined the choir and schola there. Simultaneously, Father Berg was our pastor at the time, and he had hired a professional choir director who had extensive knowledge in Gregorian chant, having studied at the Abbey of Solem, as well as more prominently study chant under Dr. Mary Berry at the University of Cambridge. Dr. Mary Berry was an Augustinian canonist and one of the foremost experts in chant. So he began to pass on some of his knowledge to me, but it wasn't until I moved away from him and I didn't have him to rely on anymore that I began studies of my own and began directing scholas. And that's when I really began to learn much more about the chant. Then in 2010, I went to France to the Abbey of Solem to study chant with Dom Daniel Saunier, who's the head of the chant department at Solem, and then returned again in 2013, but this time to a medieval music college in Tours, where Saunier was teaching at the time. So that was 2013, last year. And so for the last 15 years or so, chant has been a huge part of my life.
Excellent, thank you. There's a lot of talk, particularly in trad circles, but also in conservative Novus Ordo circles, about, you know, Gregorian chant and what its proper place is in the liturgy, especially since Vatican II, when all kinds of music from secular sounding to vernacular to the absolutely profane has entered the church. So I guess first what we should talk about is, what exactly is Gregorian chant and where can we say it originated?
Well, the first question, what is Gregorian chant? It's really sung prayer. And as St. Augustine tells us, those who sing well pray twice. And that's first and foremost, is that the chant is a prayer. Where does it come from? What are its origins? Again, I'd like to state that I'm not a musicologist. That's not my primary focus. My focus is on interpretation and performance of chant. But I'll try to cover the history of chant, what it is, where it comes from, in not in detailed specifics, but in an overall sense. The origins of the chant go back to the Jewish tradition of chanting in the synagogues. The apostles and their disciples, being of a Jewish tradition, spread out and evangelized all over the old world. In every country they visited, each had its own style of music and singing. And when they converted, they simply sang the Holy Scriptures according to the way in which they were familiar. So when Rome finally converted, they were chanting in the way that Romans naturally sing. In the region of Spain, they had their way of singing, and Gaul had their way of singing. And then the Gaul is the region which is today now France and Belgium, Switzerland, etc. The old chant of the region of Gaul is known as the Gallican chant, which no longer exists. But from the beginning of time, all the way up until the late 9th and 10th centuries, there was no musical notation. Music was passed on in an oral tradition, and it was also an integral part of their life and education. But during the first 3 centuries of the Christian Church, the chants must have been rather simple and rudimentary, since they were under heavy persecution, and they were primarily confined to small buildings and catacombs. The style of the chanting in these early centuries is known as cantillation, and is more musical than speech, but not quite yet a full song. The remnants of this style can still be heard in the reading tones for the Epistle and Gospel, the Confiteor at a solemn high mass, the preface, and the lamentations of Tenebrae. This is the traditional and ancestral way of passing on any sacred teaching, especially to large groups of people in times when microphones and speakers didn't exist, because the singing voice naturally carries farther than the spoken voice.
And that also says something to the design of churches, that churches had to be designed acoustically suitable for a choir of 10 to 15 men singing to be able to fill every single part of that church without recourse to speakers and microphones.
Right, exactly, especially when you consider the huge size of some of those cathedrals. They'd have to be constructed in a way that really projects the sound. Which takes us back to the early 4th century, when the persecutions end and the Christians are free to worship openly, and they begin to build these churches larger and more beautiful, and they begin to elaborate the liturgy a little bit and to enhance the chants. Each one of these elements reflects the other. In a time of musical oral tradition, when music was an essential part of their life and their being, improvisation held an important part in the development of the chants. Now, it's not entirely certain, but it's often believed that the first Schola Cantorum in Rome was instituted by Pope Leo I in the middle of the 5th century. And by the time Gregory the Great assumes the pontificate, it seems that the majority of the Roman chants have already been composed. But it's also believed that Gregory revised the Schola, as he did the liturgy for the Roman basilicas, and he may have composed some hymns, but his primary involvement with the chant was that he organized the arrangement of chants, or rather edited the already existing Annales Cantus, the cycle of chants, that Pope Leo had already organized. And these, again, it wasn't so much the chants as it was the texts of the chants, because obviously musical notation had not been invented yet. And this revised Schola continued to enrich the existing repertoire as well as develop new chants for new feasts and new functions, such as the introit, or the entrance chant, which has been attributed to Pope Celestine but may have come later under Leo or Gregory. And this brings us to the question of when, where, and how did Gregorian chant enter the picture here. Now, so far I've mentioned how in each region or country there existed its own cultural style of singing, and how Rome had fallen from the great pagan empire of the world to being raised up as the great head of Christianity, having its own Schola Cantorum in the 5th century. Now, if we fast forward to the middle of the 8th century, we see we have a rapprochement beginning between the Frankish kingdom, ruled by Pepin the Short and his son Charlemagne, and the papacy of St. Stephen and his successors. At first it seems to be political. The estates of the papacy were being threatened by the Germanic Lombards, and Pepin was anxious to ensure his legitimate right to the throne. Pepin promised to protect the papal estates, and Pope Stephen II went to Gaul with his Roman clergy and choir, and made a long stay at the Abbey of Saint-Denis, which is in the northern outskirts of modern-day Paris. Pepin, having witnessed the Roman liturgy and chant at the coronation mass, he realized that if he adopted the Roman liturgy throughout his kingdom, he could ensure and strengthen both religious and political unity. And so he did. He sent bishops and cantors to Rome to study, and he had bishops and cantors from Rome come to Metz, the cathedral of Metz, to teach them there. Charlemagne also issued numerous decrees to promote the introduction of the Roman chant and to invent a way of notating it, probably as a way of preserving it and possibly a way of teaching it. The introduction of the Roman liturgy and chant into Gaul had the practical result of suppressing the Gallican chant and replacing it with the Roman. Now, no written account has come down to us of what happened at this time, but of all the various theories, the following seems the most likely. At the time that the Roman chants were being adopted by the Gauls, some kind of cross-fertilization occurred. It was a simple enough to adopt the texts of the chants, which were written down, but quite a different matter regarding the melodies, which were of a different style and were not written down. Now, the overall style of the Roman chant, its basic structure, was adopted by the Gallican musicians, but they covered it over with their own style of ornamentation, thus creating a kind of hybrid chant, the whole of which is an exceptional masterpiece. And an entire century would pass before musical notation was invented for these chants. The first manuscripts containing these primitive forms of notation come from the very end of the 9th, but more importantly, from the beginning of the 10th century. The Cantatorium of the Abbey of St. Gall in Switzerland appears around 922, and the manuscript of the Cathedral of Laon from about 930. But this imposition of a new repertory on the entire West, this new hybrid, met with a great deal of resistance in Gaul, in Milan, Spain, and in Rome itself. But two conditions helped to bring about the success of such an upheaval. One was the invention of a system of notating these melodies, which marks a considerable turning point in the history of music, and two, the attribution of this new chant to one of the most famous figures of Christian antiquity, Pope Saint Gregory the Great, who of course was a doctor of the church and a father of the church. And
I was going to say, so the old pictures that we're familiar with Pope Saint Gregory the Great composing Gregorian chant notation, and the Holy Ghost is singing in his ear as he's copying down what the Holy Ghost is singing, so that, you know, since notation wasn't invented for another four centuries, that would be wrong in its actual in point of fact in terms of the chant notation. But nevertheless, it, you know, is correctly hinting on the principle of Gregory's importance in the chant reform.
Right. Yeah, and so that brings us to the very, very old belief that Gregory himself composed the chants that we now sing. And while it's possible that he may have composed some hymns or whatnot, the idea that he composed most of the repertory is false, and I'll list essentially 10 reasons why. One is that, as Pope, he has far too many other responsibilities to spend time composing music. Especially when one considers how, at this time in Rome, they were in both physical and religious danger, having been sacked twice in the last 100 years, and were now in the danger of the Lombards, who were both invading Italy and were supporters of the Arian heresy. 2. Musical notation did not exist, and he would have had to have taught his melodies to his singers orally. 3 is that the corpus of the chants is well over 1,000 pieces. It's virtually impossible for a pope, among his other innumerable duties, to have the time to compose over 1,000 various chants, and also then have the time to orally teach those thousands of chants, all within the time frame of a 14-year pontificate. 4. Another obstacle is the fact that he was often very ill, sometimes unable to even get out of bed to offer Mass. So 14 years to compose thousands of chants and teach them when you're very sick, you don't have much time. 5, he was a doctor and a father of the church due to his many writings on theology and commentaries on books of the Bible. Yet for someone who supposedly wrote this chant, he never wrote anything about music, except for one of his decrees in 595, in which he speaks about the reprehensible custom of selecting deacons only because of their musical skill and beautiful voice. And then he says that for readings of the epistle and gospel that they should choose clergy of lower ranks. 6, consider that Hildegard of Bingen, in her 67 years in a convent, was only able to write 159 chants. Mm. 7, the earliest mentions of Gregory, this is an important one, the very earliest mentions of Gregory having anything to do with the chants themselves, other than their organization, come from the late 8th and 9th centuries. 200 to 300 years after him, and at the same time that Charlemagne is working to supplant the local chants with the Roman chants. 8. Saint Gregory helped convert England via Saint Augustine of Canterbury, and the English were very proud of their Gregorian heritage, yet they never claimed that he wrote chant. 9. Aside from all of this, analytical and comparative studies of chant show beyond any doubt that the melodies of the Roman repertory were not written at any one time, but are the result of multiple evolutionary processes over several centuries. 10. The quote-unquote Gregorian chants are a hybrid of Roman and Gallican chants in the 8th century, as we already mentioned. Now, if anything could be said to resemble the chant of the time of St. Gregory, it would be the what's known as the Old Roman chants, of which there are 5 extant manuscripts which still remain, and these come from various basilicas in Rome. But those were written around the 13th century, but they more than likely represent, they do represent the chant of the time in Rome. Mm-hmm. So obviously the hybrid chant from Gaul had not supplanted the chant in Rome yet, at least not in the basilicas. And lastly, so point number 11, one of the, as you mentioned, there's this image of Gregory with this dove perched on his shoulder, whispering into his ear, and oftentimes it's thought that he's inspiring Gregory with these melodies for the chants. Now this, it's often understood that this is the Holy Ghost inspiring him for the chants, but where does this story come from? Well, it comes from a monk of Whitby in England between the years 704 and 714, when he writes about this dove whispering divine inspiration into Gregory's ear, but it's inspiration for his commentary on the book of Ezekiel. The story was later retold, either intentionally or accidentally, as whispering chants to him. But it was originally written as inspiration for his commentary.
Fascinating. So then, from this period of this hybridization of Gaelic and Roman chant, how did chant then develop in the Middle Ages throughout the rest of Europe and in Rome itself?
Well, remembering that the invention of musical invention of musical notation, it was always passed on and performed by oral transmission. Now, the invention of a system of notating music, that is, taking something which is auditory and trying to depict it visually, this began to put an end to the oral tradition, to the organic development, and to a truly free and living performance. Saint Isidore of Seville said in the early 7th century, quote, "Unless the musical sounds are retained by the human memory, they perish because they cannot be written down," end quote. Now, this is true not only because notation did not yet exist at his time, but because with notation, the singers become glued to the page and the original freedom and life is lost. I like to make an analogy with that. If you imagine actors on a stage, if you were to see actors who never learned their lines or their blocking, but they always performed a scene by reading off the script. I say this, you say that, I move here, you move there. The scene would be absolutely dead. And the scene doesn't come to life until they memorize everything, but even more than that, more than memorization, they learn it to the point where it's a natural part of them. And then the scene comes to life. It's the same with music. It won't come to life until you memorize it and it becomes a part of you. But the notation did have its advantages too. It aided in the memory when more and more chants were coming along. It lightened the memory's load, so to speak. And it also helped with the composition of new melodies. Now, the first form of notation looked like chicken scratch to our modern eyes, and that is without any staff lines. It's called in campo aperto, in an open field. It merely showed the shape of the melody and some minor rhythmical nuances. Later in the 10th century, they began to distribute some of these symbols above and below one or two lines. And in the first half of the 11th century, a Benedictine monk and a musical theorist named Guido d'Arezzo, he added two more lines, bringing it to a total of four. Thus is born the musical staff. He also added to it the little clef signs, so as to tell you where the half steps are in a diatonic scale. And then, of course, he also brought about the names of the degrees of the scale, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, which he took from the hymn to St. John the Baptist, Utque ant laxis. Square notes had also come into use, as well as simple, primitive forms of harmony known as organum and eson. But the polyphony wasn't really born until the construction of the Cathedral of Notre Dame of Paris in the 12th century. A huge, ornate Gothic cathedral in an important place such as Paris would demand music which properly reflected it. Now, the book, the Magnus Liber, is a medieval compilation of compositions of the of the earliest form of polyphony as we might think of it today. Actually, the earliest form of polyphony comes from the Musica Inciriadis, but that's a different kind of polyphony. Among the number of anonymous biographers of the time, one is known as Anonymous Four. He tells us that these compositions in the Magnus Liber, they are compositions of 2, 3, and 4 parts. He says they were written by two men, the first, Leonan, and his successor, Perrotin. and they were in the 12th and 13th century in the Ars Antiqua style. They were then succeeded by Guillaume de Machaut in the 14th century in the Ars Nova style. This polyphonic way of composing quickly spread throughout Europe, and Gregorian chant was more and more left by the wayside. So you have this blossoming of these Gothic cathedrals, and the church has become bigger and more grander and more eloquent. Same with the music. And so, you know, this fascination with polyphony and harmony and metered rhythm, they become so enamored and fascinated by it that they kind of forget about chant. And also because the notation, again, the singers become more and more glued to the page. And so the free expression of the chant is slowly lost, and the chant itself becomes more performed in a more metrical way. And so eventually they slowly, it becomes more and more difficult to sing the chant, and they like the polyphony more.
So as polyphony spreads about Europe, does it begin to take on certain secular airs? I mean, because you see, you know, older music that's performed that's polyphonic, it actually sounds very beautiful, but it's entirely secular music, secular harmonies, even sometimes for the inn and tavern. Mm-hmm. And so does any of this begin to enter into the mass?
Sure. And of course, you know, notation is born from the church. Polyphony is born from the church. And so this naturally has an influence on the secular music as well. But of course, then it's reciprocal. Secular chants are then taken up by the sacred music composers. Some of them, I forget which composer it was, but the bishop recognized the tune as a secular tune about some rather risque topics, and that was quickly dismissed and put an end to. But they also began to, in the secular, sacred realm, they would often, in their polyphonic and metrical pieces, they would make parodies of the Gregorian chants that were based on the chants, but then further developed in this long polyphonic metrical performance. And so that kind of that was their fascination, and chant was, again, nobody really knew how to perform it anymore by the time you get to the Renaissance.
So is this the state of things at the Council of Trent?
All right, so by the time Council of Trent comes along, you know, mostly they're concerned with the Protestant Reformation and all these things, but they're also concerned with the state of music in the church. And part of what had occurred throughout the previous centuries is with the chants, they began to... they composed a lot of what are called sequences, which are simply ecclesiastical compositions. There were hundreds of those. And also with some of the chants like the Kyrie and other chants, they would take the regular chant text, and where you, on certain syllables where you have a melisma, that is a long series of notes sung to one syllable, they would insert text into that melisma. And so now, instead of having a long series of notes on one syllable, it's now distributed over pretty much one note per syllable. And that's what we call troping. And they made tropes or syllabication.
Isn't that the origin of the names for the various Kyries that you see in the Liber today?
Exactly. So if you see Kyrie 11, Orbis Factor, that's because they filled in all of the long melismas, the long notes of the Kyrie, with text. Kyrie orbis factor such and such, da da da. Kyrie fons bonitatis. If I can remember how that one goes. So Kyrie fons bonitatis. Kyrie. They filled that all in with Kyrie fons bonitatis pater ingenite da 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 eleison. And so that would be trope or syllabication. And this became very widespread. And so by the time Council of Trent comes along, they're concerned that people are becoming too much focused on music and making things really interesting and cool, and not enough about the spirituality of the text and the music, and that the text is being lost for the sake of music.
Sounds familiar. Well, they think it was a lot cooler back then than in the 60s, but
right. Right. So nevertheless, so there was a certain loss, a detriment that happened at Trent in the way of music. They forbade tropes for a good reason, and they got rid of almost all of the sequences except for five. So today we still have five sequences, such as the Veni Sancte Spiritus, Veni Creator, Dies Irae,
Stabat Mater,
and
Laudacion.
Laudacion, right. And but all the other ones were dismissed. And the other thing that they did was, because chant had become so corrupted at the time, and that is that it had become so metrical and so heavy, that all of the long melismas were too difficult for them to sing, and too long to sing because everything had been slowed down. So what they decided was they would truncate, they would cut out all of these long, beautiful melismas and shorten it all down. And that became the norm then. And so by the time you get to the 17th century, 17th or 18th century, so 1600s, when the Kyrie, which is currently labeled for Mass 8, Misa de Angelis, that Kyrie was composed in the 16th, 1700s. The performance of that Kyrie at the time, see if I can get the previous Kyrie out of my head and remember Kyrie 8. So the Kyrie for Mass 8, Misa de Angelis, at the time that it was composed, today we normally hear it sung as Kyrie eleison. But that's not how it would have been sung when they first composed it, because at that time, it was very late. It was during the Renaissance and Baroque era, and the chant, like the polyphony, was metrical, and it was sung heavily. So it would have been more like Kyrie. Etc. So you can see, very, as Dom Guéranger said, explained the way chant was at his time, a long succession of heavy, boring square notes, unable to inspire a single sentiment in the soul, or something along those lines. Mm. That was the state of chant from pretty much almost from the beginning of polyphony to the restoration period at Solesmes in the middle of the 1800s,
which would then be one of the reasons why polyphony takes over, and there's a reliance on polyphony and a focus on that and all the major composers, you know, Palestrina, Talis, Bird, you know, or even they start borrowing from secular composers like Monteverdi in his madrigals, which he composed at Mantua. They start, which are secular love poetry, actually.
Right.
And they start converting these into use. They just reapply sacred text to them, as opposed to the paganized romantic text that Monteverdi was composing for the Dukes of Mantua.
Right.
So they're focusing on that because they've left the tradition of chant behind, and these heavy notes are just too burdensome, except to be used as a slight introduction before running into polyphony, like Verdi's Vespers or something of this sort.
Right, and that's why you see a lot of times in the Renaissance and the Baroque era, Palestrina, Victoria, Talis, and Bird, etc., they're not only composing motets and polyphonic motets, polyphonic settings of the Mass, of the ordinary of the Mass, but they're also composing polyphonic settings of the propers of the Mass, and of the responsories of the Divine Office. You imagine, you know, how long a Mass would have been then with these long polyphonic settings of not just the ordinary, but of the propers as well, and especially with the Divine Office. The Divine Office is sung in polyphony. It really did reach a ridiculous state. And so, again, at the time of Palestrina, the Pope almost outlawed polyphony. He was going to outlaw it. And then, of course, Palestrina wrote his Mass, Missa Papa Marcelli, you know, in honor of him, to illustrate that, look, polyphony can still be done in a proper way, you know. And, of course, it pleased him and placated him. And so he said, okay, I won't outlaw it.
Right. This is Pope Paul IV, by the way.
Right.
The close of the Council of Trent. Well, before we start talking, you mentioned Guérinier, and I want to get to that in the 19th century reform at Salem. But before we do that, I wanted to pick your brain on the subject, namely in the Protestant musical tradition, which obviously has the same common font as the rest of Europe, but then there's different views. There's the Calvinist attitude, of course, which is that all adornment to liturgy is evil and popish, is bad. It distracts from the gospel, so we have to get rid of it. But others actually try to incorporate it, what they thought was a simplified version. So like in England, Cranmer advocated cutting the chant and the polyphony, getting all boys out. No boys, the high voices, because he thought it was effeminate. He didn't want that. So his thought, of course, he wasn't able to implement it until after Henry VIII died. Under Edward VI was much more Calvinist, but he wanted one note for one word and nothing more. And it stays this way until Elizabeth kind of reverts back to what Henry had. Mm-hmm. And likewise, you see also in Switzerland and other places, they seem to, wherever they had chant, it seems like they applied the same principle. But then you get Bach in the next century.
Mm-hmm.
So how did the Protestants take on the musical tradition, because they even use Latin at different times, right, in their worship, as you see with Bach. Mm-hmm. A lot of Protestant writers love to write masses. Mm-hmm. But do any of them make use of chant, you know, and how do they employ the polyphony?
I'm not too familiar with the Protestant side of it, but it is interesting how some Protestant composers, they still wrote music for the Catholic Church, because that's where they got a lot of their money, because the Catholic Church recognized quality, and they said, well, such and such composer may not be Catholic, but he's writing Catholic music, and it's of the utmost quality, and therefore, you know, we can use that. Much like Gregory the Great said that about the liturgy, whatever is good can be used. I don't know the exact quote, but he wasn't opposed to minor changes here and there as long as it was good. But it's interesting in the way that England, that the path that England took, because before the Protestant split in England, like Europe, all the music was Catholic, and you had the great composers such as Tallis and William Byrd. And then the Protestant split, Cranmer and Henry VIII and whatnot, and Anglicanism comes in. But the Anglican musical way of composing is of the same tradition as the Catholic way of composing. And so the Anglican style of music is naturally born and continued in the Catholic style of English composition. In mainland continental Europe, the same thing happens. The Protestants take a different path of composition under Luther and Calvin and whatnot. But the Catholic composition in continental Europe remains top-notch and good until the French Revolution. Mm. And when the French Revolution comes along, they institute the conservatoire, and they get rid of the old master-apprentice relationship, and they create this systematized, this political systematized way of teaching and performing music. And if you pay attention and you listen and observe music from continental Europe from the time of the French Revolution onward, it really degrades. And that's when you start getting a lot of cheesy, corny music, especially in the late 1800s, early 1900s. Whereas in England, the effects of the French Revolution, musically anyway, didn't affect England as much. And England, to this day, still retains a lot of the old master-apprentice relationship in some of their colleges. And so their way of polyphonic composition wasn't really affected the way continental Europe was, which is why England is today considered the best. They have the best choral, best choirs of, you know, and best composers, because their music is still, though perhaps some of their music textually and in some ways may, textually speaking, is not always Catholic, their musical composition still carries through the tradition of the Catholic way of composing, without being affected by this, French Revolution of the philosophy of enlightenment and the Masonic influence and whatnot, which mainland Europe was.
Mm-hmm. I think it's also one of the supreme ironies that the corniest tunes in English music were actually written by a Catholic named Elgar, who wrote for King Edward VII. Anyway, I don't want to go down that rabbit hole. Go back now to Dom Guéranger, since you mentioned the French Revolution. Dom Guéranger begins in the ashes of the French Revolution at the time of the restored Bourbon monarchy under Louis XVIII and XIX, and because then later he's expelled by the Second Republic, which tried to renew the old commune and kick out anybody that was seen as not contributing to the state, and then was able to come back. So what... students of chant history know Dom Guéranger instituted a reform to attempt to restore Gregorian chant. Up to this time, all the chant for the Missal is being written in Regensburg, and they're the main publishers for a chant that's used in the Roman Missal and the Divine Office. So how does Dom Guéranger begin the work of restoring chant, and how does he manage to displace Regensburg in being the official composers of chant for the Holy See?
Well, it was... a long process, and he wasn't necessarily much of a musical man himself, but he had a very good musical intuition, very good musical judgment, and he first was a priest and canon of the Cathedral of Le Mans, and then later became Benedictine. And he grew up in the little town of Solesmes, in Sable-sur-Sarthe, along the river Sarthe there in France. And in that town of Solesmes, there was this old ruined priory, which he wanted to rebuild and restore monastic life. Because at the time, through the French Revolution and whatnot, almost all monastic life in France had been expelled. So he wanted to restore not only the church and the faith and monastic life in France, but also the chant, because he saw how corrupted it become, how, as he said, you know, just this heavy, boring succession of square notes, unable to inspire a single thing in the soul. And there were other musicologists at his time who had similar ways of thinking. And some of them had discovered the old, original, ancient manuscripts of the chant written in that what looked like chicken scratch to them. And they knew that in order to do a proper restoration of the chant, they had to go back to the sources. And so back to the first chicken scratch notation, which didn't have any musical staff, and then also the first forms of musical notation with a staff, so that you have more precise indications of pitch, or at least relevant pitch with their intervals. And so he got permission to restore the priory of Solesmes. It wasn't an abbey yet. And he had a small community, and he, I think it was in the 1840s, he charged one of his monks, Dom Jaussion, J-A-U-S-O-N or something like that, Jaussion, he appointed him to travel Europe, to go to various abbeys and monasteries, cathedrals, searching for all manuscripts of chant that he could find, copy them, and if possible, borrow them to bring back to the abbey and to the priory of Solesmes and copy them there to study them. And Jaussion took on a pupil, Dom Potier, and he's a very important figure because he kind of first realized how to decipher some of these old chicken scratch notations. When he took the chicken scratch notation and he placed that, he superimposed that above the square note notation, the first forms of square note notation for the same piece of chant. And when he did that, then all of a sudden he could see how he could make some sense of the old notation, chicken scratch notation. He could see how it moved, and it kind of had the same shape as the square notes. And a very good friend of Dom Géranger, the founder, was Canon Gontier, one of the other canons of Le Mans, who was also very musical. And he worked closely with the monastery of Solesmes. And Potier and Gontier kind of developed their own ways, their own theories and practices that weren't too different from each other. But Gontier was a very good friend of Géranger and an important influence in their work. And Potier's successor and disciple was the famous Dom Mocquereau. And Mocquereau was the one who came up with what is known as the Old Solesmes method. And they produced the first, I can't remember if it was a Gradoale or a Liber, but in 1908 when they produced their first full publication of a chant book with the restored chants. And in 1908, I don't think they had the rhythmical markings yet. They did. I don't think they had the dots and the ictus and the epizemas placed in yet. It was just the notes, mm-hmm. if I'm not mistaken. And a little bit prior to this, they had been in contact with Rome and St. Pius IX and Pius X. And Pius X saw the value in their work. And when the contract between Regensburg?
Regensburg,
right.
Teleprompter free radio.
Right. When their contract came up with Rome, when it time to renew, Pius X decided to sign a new contract with Solem instead and make them the official publication of the chant books. And so they were. And 1908, they came out with their first book, followed shortly thereafter, 1912, I think was the Monastic Antiphonale. And then again in 1934, they released another. And in 1912, I think when the rhythmical markings came in. But at that time, you have to think, they started their research pretty much around, I think the official date is given as 1956.
You mean 18?
1856, sorry, 1856. And they're publishing these books in 1912, 1934. The notes between 1912 and 1934 are essentially the same. That's 50, 60 years of research. 50, 60 years to try to unravel this mystery of music, which was, you know, 1300 years prior to them. 50, 60, even 70 years is really not enough time, especially during a time when you don't have digital photos, you don't have phone calls and emails, traveling is very slow, communication is slow. So in order to gather all this information and to make this research is very, very slow. So by the time when they make these first publications and their Solem method, so to speak, they knew this was not the end. This was not their final work. This was simply a big step in the process. And part of the idea behind the Old Solem method was that they knew at their time the common practice of the chant was very heavy and metrical, as previously demonstrated. And how, when that is so common, how are you going to get people to break away from that and to sing more freely? Well, you can't do it all in one night. And so they had to develop a way that was essentially still rhythmical in some way, but more free than what they were used to. It's a stepping stone. And this helped people all around the world to slowly break away from their heavy, monotonous, rhythmical way of singing the chant. And especially now that they've restored all these long melismas, it gave them a way of really kind of gauging it and a stepping stone towards singing more freely. Mm. And Mokuro knew that. He admitted as much that, this was not the end-all be-all. They still needed to... They didn't fully understand the ancient notations at that time. But they couldn't wait forever. They couldn't wait, well, we're not going to publish anything until we fully understand this, because who knows how long that's going to be. So they have to produce something. And they did. So after Mokuro, his disciple was Dom Gajard. And Gajard wanted to be a perfect disciple of Mokuro. He knew the same as Mokuro, that further research had to be done. But he was content with the quote-unquote Old Solem method. And it had a practical function as well. The monks at Solem, as in any monastery, they don't have a lot of time devoted to practicing the chant. They sing it day in and day out, but as far as a scholar practice goes, they only have maybe half an hour a week for practicing the chants. And so the old Solem method was practical. It made it somewhat easy for them to practice. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, Dom Eugene Cardine was, during the 50s and 60s, he was continuing the tradition of analyzing, investigating, researching all these old ancient notations to try to really decipher them. So Dom Cardine and his associate, Dom Ullier, they finally made a huge breakthrough in the interpretation of these old ancient notations in the 60s and 70s. And Cardine was a professor at the Pontifical Institute of Sacred Music in Rome. So he published two books as part of his... what do you call it? The books that you use... for a school,
textbooks.
Yeah, it was part of the textbooks for his students there, and the second book of which goes in depth to explaining the signs, mostly of the notation of the Abbey of St. Gall, their signs and their interpretations. And this is what's often referred to as semiology. And Cardine is often called the father of semiology. His work was then continued, somewhat simultaneous to him was Dom Jean-Claire. And Jean-Claire took Gajard's place as the director of the choir at Solem. And Jean-Claire was a master in studying the modes, whereas Cardine was a master of the interpreting the old ancient notations. And then there was another a friend of theirs, again a canon from Le Mans, like Gantier, who was Canon Jeannoteau. And these three men, Cardine, Jean-Claire, and Jeannoteau, were the three mentors to Dom Saunier, who is currently the head of the Paléographie Musicale, the chant department at Solem, and who is my mentor for the most part. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the history of Solem there, that from the very beginning with Dom Guéranger, objectives with the restoration, to have a proper restoration, is based on the ancient notations of the 9th and 10th centuries.
Mm. Now, with the Solem reform, there's a couple of things. One, at least concurrently, Solem was criticized by Monsignor Bartolucci, who is the papal master of ceremonies from Pius XII until John Paul II. He died just recently. He had said that, or criticized Solem, at least, you know, since the council, as being, you know, too effeminate, as their voices weren't manly enough, as he thought. Is that just the Italian versus French perception, or is there a truth to that? Is it that their work hasn't been complete, and is it that the collapse of chant and sacred music since Vatican II, where they destroyed the plates for the Liber, they had to be restored. Has that affected the research into chant?
Has it affected their research, or has it affected their performance of it?
Both and. So that now it's viewed as this is no longer needed, so are they not putting the same effort and time into it that they used to, or allowed some change that's perceived to be in line with Vatican II, or something of that sort?
I don't have all the in-depth knowledge of the ins and outs between Solem and Rome. But Dom Saunier being a friend and mentor of mine, I have some inside knowledge. And I do know that during the second half of the 1990s, I think starting in 96, Solem began to produce a restoration of chants for the Divine Office, for the Benedictine Office. And they produced four volumes. Mm-hmm. Obviously, according to the Novus Ordo, right. But then in the early 2000s, in 2005, there were two books for the Roman Antiphonale, which is really more of a Vesperale because most of the chants in there are all for Vespers and some of Lauds. But for whatever reason, he explained it to me once and I forget what it is, but the second, only the second volume has been released so far, mm-hmm. Antiphonale 2, and we're still waiting for Antiphonale 1 to be released. Again, but this is according to the Novus Ordo right. organization of the chants and texts. Now, what we, the most anticipated and waited for is what Vatican II asked for, which was the critical edition of the Graduale, the chants of the Mass. So to this day, the chants we find in the Liber, in the Graduale Romanum, the Graduale Triplex, mm-hmm. they are still the same chants that were produced at the beginning of the 1900s. With the Graduale Triplex, now we have the advantages of having the ancient St. Gall and Laon notation superimposed above and beneath that notation, but it still hasn't been updated since. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how long it's going to be before we get there. There's a lot of inside rigmarole, you could say, going on inside of Solem. There's a lot of tension between certain things, so things are moving a little bit slowly. But as far as the performance, has Vatican II at all affected their performance, effeminacy? I would say no, because if you listen, there are some recordings you can find, even on YouTube, of Solem in the 1904 with Dom Mocaro directing. And they still sound pretty much the same. They have a different sound, and obviously the sound quality is different, but it's a very typical French. And but even Bernard of Clairvaux said the same thing. I don't remember the exact quote, but it's something along the lines of how he despised it. He said, you know, chant should, it's despicable to hear chant sung in this weak, effeminate, nasally tone. It should really be sung in a strong and vibrant voice, you know. He was French, and so obviously it was something that was goes back even as far as Clairvaux, the way that the French sang.
How about others? Are there other schools of chant out there? For example, sometimes Les Barreaux is cited mm-hmm. as a great exponent of chant, and their voices, Falconbeau as well. How did they compare with Solem?
Well, Solem, despite the chant research that they do, they don't follow the old Solem method anymore, obviously because it's it was only a stepping stone. But they don't fully embrace the semiological approach either, and that is interpreting the chant according to the ancient notations, partially because a lot of the monks there, the older monks, prefer the older way. But also because they don't really have a lot of time to spend doing a lot of nuanced things. However, there are other communities which do embrace and utilize the semiological approach, such as the convent of Saint Cecile in Solesmes, right down the road from monks. They use a much more semiological interpretation of the chant. Their numbers are very few now, and they're mostly all older, so their voices are, you can tell they're older women singing. There's also the Archabbey of St. Meinrad in Indiana, where you have Father Columba Kelly, who was a student of Cardine, and they use semiological approach there, as far as I know. I don't know to what extent. But with Fonkombeau and Loubarou, Fonkombeau is pretty much hardcore Old Solesmes method. And I'm not sure why, but might possibly be due to this. They simply want to resist Vatican II, and they think that adhering to the Old Solesmes method is traditional, and that semiological is not traditional but modern. But really, it's quite the opposite, because if you think about it, semiological approach is really traditional, having been from the 9th and 10th centuries. Mm-hmm. So Fonkombeau and, of course, their daughter houses, such as Clear Creek, mm-hmm. are strictly Old Solesmes. Loubarou, they are mostly Old Solesmes, but they make some exceptions. They don't adhere entirely to it. They're a little bit more flexible in their interpretation. And really, I really do prefer the chanting of Loubarou above that of Fonkombeau. Mm-hmm.
Is anybody composing chant today? Is anybody trying to take what's been discovered through the 170 years of research beginning with Dom Guéranger and try to produce new texts of chant? They try to, you know, to pioneer anything within the tradition?
Well, certainly in the Novo Sordo, you've got figures such as Father Columba Kelly, who's the chant master at the Archabbey of St. Meinrad. He and some of his disciples, students such as Adam Bartlett, they are undertaking the task of trying to compose English chants for the Novo Sordo Mass in the vernacular, trying to beautify and make the vernacular Novo Sordo Mass as respectable as possible by giving them some kind of a Gregorian-esque English chant. But as far as the Latin chants go, you have in Solesmes, because they're the official ones to do it, anytime a new feast comes along that requires they have certain texts which are set for that mass which don't already have a chant to accompany them, then the monks at Solesmes, and again, not all the monks at Solesmes are musical. And just as in any monastery, most monks are not musical. There's only a select few at any monastery who are really musical. And so the same is at Solesmes. So the one, two, or three people, in this case at Solesmes, it's pretty much just Dom Saunier now. He would, under current circumstances, he would be the one to compose a new chant setting for a text. How would they do that? He would try to find an ancient chant, and using the process of what they call contrafractura, adapt that melody to this setting of the text. And that was done in the ancient days as well. Mm-hmm. There were various ways of composition in the old days and in the early centuries. So that's kind of what they do today. Like Signum Manium, the introit for the Assumption. It used to be Gaudete, mm-hmm. but then when it became an official feast day, then they gave it the introit of Signum Manium. And
well, actually, it was already an official feast day, but once the dogma was proclaimed, right, its dignity elevated,
right.
So they redid the office. In fact, most people, if you have an older breviary from the 30s or the 40s, my Benedictine is 35. If you look in there, you have the old feast of the Assumption on August 15th, and usually in an appendix inserted into the backs, usually rebound, they have the new office, which was composed in 53.
Right. So prior to being a dogma, the introit was a Gaudete, and that was an ancient mm-hmm. ancient text, ancient chant.
Right.
When Signum Manium was chosen to be the introit after being proclaimed a dogma, that text didn't already have a chant to accompany it. So they had to come up with something. So they borrowed a chant from one of the other ancient ones, and they modified it to fit this new text. Well, not new text because it's from the Apocalypse, but they modified that melody to fit this text. Mm-hmm. And so that's part of the way they do that. But as far as just creating a new chant, that's not really done. Mm-hmm. Except I did find somebody, I don't know who or when, but somebody has made a chant setting for the prayer of Saint Michael the Archangel in Latin. And it's decent. Mm-hmm. It sounds nice, but there's problems in it. It doesn't follow. It doesn't really follow the ancient rules for chant.
Mm-hmm. So that's to tie things together with respect to the rules of ancient chant. Taking the Salem reform in Fine, and is it an authentic restoration of the ancient chant, whether it be the ancient, the old Roman chant, or as it was in the 9th and 10th century?
Well, that's an interesting question, because obviously we don't have any audio recordings prior to the late 1800s or whenever audio recordings first came into being. So to know exactly how something was sung 1500 years ago, 1800 years ago, it's quite impossible. The best we can do is look at the facts of what we have, and that is the first forms of musical notation, which is
the chicken scratch.
The chicken scratch, right, without staff lines. Then the first forms of musical notation with a staff, mm-hmm. And then also testimonies from those centuries regarding the music at the time, such as Musica and Kyriadis. The problem is with those musical writings and treatises is that they're usually talking about things which are not common sense to them at the time. Things which are more important that are easily to be forgotten for them. And so really the most important thing is that which is not mentioned. Mm-hmm. Because they didn't bother mentioning it because it was just natural to them. But it's right. Not necessarily natural to us now, almost, you know, 1,500 years separated. Mm-hmm. So there, it's really impossible to get a truly authentic restoration, especially because also in those days, even though they had it notated down, it was the overall general shape of the melody, but they still had this free play with it, you know. If you listen to Arabic chants, which are still of a natural, an oral tradition, or the old recordings of traditional flamenco in Spain, you listen to those singings, these songs of an oral tradition, and you listen to the way they sing, and you think about trying to notate that down. It's quite impossible. And even if you do somehow miraculously have a way of notating it down specifically, every little note and rhythmical nuance, you give that to somebody else who doesn't already know the music and say, learn this song from this sheet.
Right.
And I want you to be able to sing it. If you listen to the way they sing it, having learned it from a piece of paper, and then listen to the one who knows it organically from an oral tradition, the difference is going to be unbelievable, you know. So we can't hope to regain an authentic restoration and way of performing it. The best we can do is to restore it to the best of our ability and sing it in a way which is natural to us at our time. And but it's an important part too, because their scales back then were not necessarily the same as we have now.
Right.
I just recently asked Sonier, I sent him an email regarding a specific Alleluia that I was trying to figure out the a restoration for. It was a very particular segment that I was struggling with, and I said, well, how, you know, according to this, would it be like this or would it be like that? I mean, what would be going on there? And he said, well, it's impossible to notate it according to our modern idea of solfege. Because this particular phrase there, at that time, they would have had a different scale. That it just wouldn't match our modern ears.
Right.
Not all the chants are like that, but in this case, that particular segment there was a really which is why I was having such a hard time of trying to figure it out. And my sources are very limited. He's got pretty much unlimited sources. So it's a difficult, long process, and we can't hope to obtain a true, perfect restoration and authentic interpretation. But what we can do is simply look at what we have, what we can gain from the evidence and the facts that we have, and try to come up with the best restoration that we can, and give it, do it honor.
All right. Thank you. And I understand that you're joining a monastery in the next week.
In about a week and a half, I'll be entering the monastery of St. Benedict in Norcia, Italy, which is the birthplace of St. Benedict. And I'll see how it goes.
All right. It'll be a great loss to the choir you're in now, and a great gain for the monastery, God willing.
God willing.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.